Today's high 43, southwest winds up to 30 miles per hour. Right now, winds are from the southwest at 13, gusting to 20. It is 39 degrees in Racine and Kenosha, 36 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
We spend this portion of today's morning show in the realm of the paranormal. And if you look at just about any reputable survey, there is quite a high percentage of Americans who believe in some kind of paranormal activity. In fact, the author of the book we're going to talk about today, Steve Volk, quotes a percentage of 70% of Americans believing in some kind of paranormal activity. That might seem extraordinary or preposterous, but in fact it's not. If you really think about what the term paranormal means, and that is something which can involve a lot of things that are not even necessarily particularly spooky or creepy or even all that amazing, but just beyond the realm of the perfectly ordinary or normal. It's also something that, first of all, many of us, to whatever extent we might believe in such a thing, are not necessarily comfortable in admitting or talking about freely. And certainly it's also something which the media tends not to treat with all that much seriousness. Or on the other hand, there are certain outlets of media that will buy into it wholeheartedly without being sufficiently skeptical. So it's just an interesting concept that many of us don't really know what to do with. And Steve Volk is trying to get us thinking about this in kind of a different way in his new book called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. He is a regular contributor to Philadelphia Magazine. His writing has appeared in Men's Journal, Men's Health, New Republic, and a number of different Philadelphia publications. He's won a number of different awards. And this book is certainly thought-provoking in the best sense of the word. Published by HarperCollins, again called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. Steve Volk, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tell us, first of all, as you approach this, what sort of historically in your life your attitude has been about the paranormal? I mean, for instance, growing up or as a young adult, have you always been fairly open to this kind of thing, or has your level of openness versus skepticism changed over the years?
Well, if anything, I've grown a little more skeptical over the years, because as a kid, I'd grown up with this family ghost story, and that's ultimately what propelled me into writing this. I remain open-minded, but hopefully not so open-minded, you know, that my brain falls out. You know, the story that I grew up with was really remarkable. I mean, I was 6 years old when it happened, so my memories are untrustworthy, as all childhood memories are. And I, you know, it's hard to be sure whether or not they're my memories or they come from having been told the story. And, but what happened was there was a huge sort of booming, thumping sound that would happen only at night, and it would wake us up out of bed. And it would, my sisters on one side of the house thought it was coming from high up in the walls of their room, and my brother and I thought it was coming from the roof over our heads. And this was a little hard because we didn't share an adjoining wall, so where exactly was the noise coming from? Our parents on the first floor thought it was just coming from somewhere upstairs, maybe on the roof of the house. And it was loud enough that it would wake them up downstairs as well. And my sisters were complaining of more dramatic things. They were saying that covers were yanked from their beds in the middle of the night, that their bed frames would shake as if somebody had grabbed the posts of the bed and were twisting them left and right, that they had seen an old woman walk through the room and just pass right through the wall. So this went on for about 9 months, and my parents looked for prosaic explanations, but none of the sort of mundane things you'd normally think of, like the house settling or a water hammer, you know, some sort of malfunction in the water pipes, seemed to account for it. This was a noise that would go on for tens of minutes at a time, that would go away and come back, and again, that would only happen at night. And eventually they thought, you know, maybe we really do have a ghost. And my father went and told the family priest. And the family priest came to the house and did the blessing ceremony that Catholics do when they move into a new place. And that night, things actually got worse. The noise went on longer and louder. And we were really frightened. The kids, we ran downstairs. And my parents were thinking of leaving for the night when the noise did something it never did before. It moved to the top of the stairs, and then it came barreling down one step at a time. My dad describes it as sounding like a really big kid throwing a tantrum, hitting each stair as hard as it could. And when it hit the bottom, it was like a big two-footed, you know, dismount, and you could feel the floor shake. And that was it. We never heard it again.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it's an incredible story. And for me, as a reporter, my credibility is really, really important.
Right. You know, I have to read this little moment as you recount this story, right, just after you've recounted this. You write, "I recognize how truly fantastic every word of the family ghost story is, and here I am, a reporter. I can hear the skeptics chortling, and I laugh right along with them."
Yeah, and I laugh, though, for a different reason, I think, than they do. I mean, they laugh at the obvious ridiculousness of it. I mean, you know, this just simply couldn't be true. It's preposterous. I laugh at the enormity of it, at the extreme quality of it. In the book, I very resolutely say I neither believe nor disbelieve in the family ghost, that this story has left me in a position where I think cognitive dissonance is my only really rational option. I know the people who reported this story to me. You know, skeptics would usually say that something like this boils down to, you know, creaking floorboards and superstition, right? Some sort of natural phenomenon that's been misinterpreted. You will not meet a less imaginative man than my father. You will not meet a man less given to histrionics. This is a guy who, with a noise like that going on, would just very stolidly set about finding the cause of it. And he couldn't. And it ended up the way it ended up. You know, it's hard for me to believe that my dad in particular would have, and there were multiple witnesses to this, but that my dad in particular would have fantasized this noise coming down the stairs. That's not the guy I know.
Hmm.
So, but the details of the story are so crazy. It's like, how can I really embrace that?
Hmm.
And I think that we need to be willing at times when we're confronted with these sorts of stories to just shrug our shoulders and say, you know, I don't know. I don't know what that was.
As you describe your dad, and you know, certainly what you write in the book confirms that description, I'm reminded of how this story and that setting and who your dad is, that's completely at odds with, for instance, some of the shows that we watch on television, which I think some of them actually probably do a disservice to your cause, that
yeah.
is of trying to get us to think more seriously and maybe openly about some of these matters. I mean, some of these shows in which, you know, people go on hunts for ghosts and this and that, and of course, it's just the opposite. I mean, they couldn't be farther from skeptics. It's not, I mean, you talk about how your family didn't want any of this, and this is very unlike them to have something like this happen. It's the last thing in the world they would ever just dream up out of their own imaginations, versus these folks we see going into buildings with their night vision goggles and so on and sophisticated recording equipment. I mean, they want and
yeah.
fully expect to
yeah.
Experience all these things as evidence of ghosts. And
yeah.
they are the opposite of who your father is, for instance.
Yeah, they're hoping for a scare. They're hoping for a tickle. And it's funny because where my I went out for over a year with a ghost hunter in Philadelphia on many cases. And the majority of people that we dealt with seemed to be getting some kind of charge out of the fact that they might have a ghost in their house. And they immediately lost some credibility, both with me and with Lou Gentile, the guy I was going out with. It made it seem as if anything that happened, they were going to interpret it as being part of this haunting or this ghost, you know. And Lou would try to talk them out of that. Lou and I became friends through the process. I mean, I started off just covering him for about 6 months for a story, or 6 or 9 months for a story I was doing for Weekly here in Philadelphia. And then after the story was done, I enjoyed my time with him so much, and I felt like I was getting so much insight into the psychology of people who are reporting hauntings that I wanted to keep going out on cases with him. So I continued to go out on hunts with him for another 9 months or so. And the thing is, though, there were some instances where things happened that we couldn't explain, where things happened that really were strange. And the one thing I'd like sort of the hardcore skeptics and the people who believe, you know, the traditional ghost is impossible to consider is that, you know, 20% of the population believes that they've experienced, had some sort of ghost experience directly. And so rather than reject all these eyewitnesses, you know, because that's ultimately what they are, they're just eyewitnesses like you'd find in a court of law, why not even open yourself up to the idea that there could be more exotic things than they're considering at work here? So in other words, instead of just superstition and maybe some want to, you know, like they want the ghost to be there, what if there is some other sort of phenomenon at play? There's a guy named Vic Tandy who's studying infrasound and this low level of sound beneath 20 hertz, beneath the range of human hearing, that has the capacity to cause visual hallucinations and create a sense of pressure in the chest, which is the sort of uneasiness people feel when they're being stared at or think they're being stared at by a ghost. And so there are just potentially things to learn here. And I'm not discounting the idea that a traditional ghost might exist. I'm just saying that even if your position is that that's impossible, at least be open to the fact that, you know, all these eyewitnesses can't merely be people who want this to go on. And I have to say, the instances in which Lou and I did run across things that were things we couldn't explain, the people were actually bothered by it and didn't want it to be going on. The places where we found naturalistic explanations seemed to be places where the people were sort of rooting for themselves to have a ghost.
I'm speaking with Steve Volk, talking about his book called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. In the book, Steve Volk recounts some of his encounters with people in pursuit of the paranormal. And he entered it as a journalist, as a reporter, with as open a mind as he possibly could, and has written a very intriguing book in the process. The introduction to the book gives us a lot to chew on, and you are obviously writing this book very much with the hardcore skeptic in mind, hoping to sort of shift him or her away from this rock-solid belief that none of this could possibly be true in any way, that it's all stuff people are just making up for one reason or another. One of the places you begin this discussion is with these words: we live in a world of false certainties. Explain what you mean by that.
Gosh, I'm so glad you've really read the book. We live in a world where we try to force conclusions on these subjects. And so, you know, one of the things that drove me to write this was watching these debates play out between the far religious right and this sort of movement that has formed of the new atheists, who speak with equal certainty or near certainty that either God does or doesn't exist. And I just think, you know, and we're forced to listen to this in the media as if this is the only two options available to us, you know, for the most part. I mean, these are the people who get sort of the widest hearing. And I think we deal with the same thing in our politics, where, you know, the Democrats and Republicans debate, and it's going on right now with the economic crisis. You know, I just want to see them solve the problem, man. I want to see them sit down and figure out a solution, and that usually, to me, would involve both sides coming down off their high horse and meeting somewhere in the middle. But when I say we operate, you know, in this sort of world of false certainties, that's what I'm talking about. You know, both sides get so sort of caught up in their own rightness and righteousness that they can't see what the other side might have to contribute. And in terms of the paranormal, the place where I think this is most evident, like most easily seen, is in UFO research. Because UFO has become synonymous for a lot of people with flying saucers. And then you get into that, it devolves into this debate where, you know, well, flying saucers either do and exist and people passionately commit to that argument, or don't, and people passionately commit to that argument. The fact is, an unidentified flying object is precisely and only that. It's unidentified. If we had enough evidence to reasonably conclude it was a weather balloon or military flares, it would no longer be an unidentified flying object. And if we had enough evidence to reasonably conclude it was an alien spacecraft, it would no longer be an unidentified flying object. And yet we try and force it to this conclusion. So, you know, if a UFO sighting is covered on TV, you know, the newscasters sort of chortle about it, and they often will interview some skeptic who will force it to some conclusion that we don't actually have enough data to reach oftentimes. And what I'm saying is, why not just admit when we don't have enough data to reach a conclusion and let an unidentified flying object be that? Let it be unidentified.
Right after you kind of bring this up, this notion of false certainties, which I find really intriguing, you discuss the word paranormal itself. And in kind of the same way that we make this leap when it comes to UFOs, that a UFO is something that somebody thinks is a spacecraft from another planet. I mean, that's not what the term UFO means at all. And when somebody says they saw a UFO, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are jumping to any of those kind of conclusions. In some respects, that's another example of what you say we sort of do with the word paranormal. How would you have us think about the word paranormal as we start thinking about some of these possibilities?
Rather than thinking of it as something that lies beyond the reach of science, I think we should think of it as something that potentially science can't reach yet, you know, or hasn't focused its attention on enough yet to come up with a real conclusion. I make a distinction in the book between the word paranormal and the word supernatural, because supernatural seems to lie, you know, firmly outside the science. Well, why not consider that all of these topics may one day be answered? And I think that you find, for me anyway, it would seem that then these topics seem less threatening to people who are devoted to science in that sort of all-encompassing way, that, well, science can explain everything. If something exists, then science can deal with it. Why not just admit that there are some things that science hasn't dealt with yet or can't explain just yet, but may eventually? And, you know, there are examples of this throughout history. There's a guy described in the introduction, Hans Berger, who ended up developing the electroencephalogram, which is the foundation of modern neuroscience. And the way he did it is really uncanny. I mean, he was World War I, and he fell off his own horse, and an artillery sort of brigade behind him was bearing down on him. And he thought he was about to be crushed. But the person sort of driving that horse-drawn carriage managed to stop it. And so he escaped with minor injuries. And when he got back from that engagement, there was a telegram from his sister saying she was sure that he was in grave danger and she wanted to be sure that he was okay. And he took this as there was no way this was a coincidence. And so he wondered how that kind of telepathy could be possible. If a signal is transmitted from himself at this time of distress to the sister he was very close to, what physical way might that have happened? And he settled on maybe it was some sort of electrical signal. Well, at this point, I guess it was around 1917, there was no thought of electrical signals or electrical activity in the brain. and he was derided and laughed and snorted at. And he doggedly pursued this, and he found electrical activity in the brain. And this now becomes the way we diagnose brain death today, the most sophisticated means we have of doing so. And, you know, in that sense, his looking for electrical activity in the brain in 1917 was a paranormal claim, right? Hmm. But it turns out to be true, and it turns out to be the foundation of everything else we've done with neuroscience since. Yay, Hans Berger, right? Yay, the paranormal, because look what it brought us.
Right. Something which, in the moment, was properly delineated as paranormal, which no longer is regarded as that.
Right.
It's become exactly. The new normal, or something that was always normal, but we just didn't know it.
Exactly.
Hmm. Yeah, and another point in the introduction, you say that as you think about these matters and about some of these possibilities and try to treat them seriously and fairly, you say, I'm not so much critiquing science as calling for more of it, particularly in areas derided as paranormal. In other words, you invite and actually long for more serious scientific treatment of some of these topics. Whereas certain folks who buy into this wholeheartedly, and some of whom we might call fanatics, have no respect for science themselves and no interest whatsoever in science weighing in. But you do.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I think for a lot of people, they want science to weigh in, but they want their result. You know what I mean? They want the result to be confirming their beliefs. And I just think we need to be more open-minded at that and hope that more scientists will get involved in this sort of research. And what we find, we find. And I think what we need to remember along the way is that at any point, you know, the findings are provisional. They're based on the technology we have now. They're based on, in to some respects, the belief systems we have now. You know, what sort of theories are scientists even willing to consider? And in that sense, we should kind of always keep our powder dry because the store of knowledge changes frequently. And, you know, it's rare when you really get to sort of fire your guns up and salute, you know, and celebrate a victory because scientific findings shift over time. I talk a little bit in the book about quantum mechanics. I try not to do too much with it. But for many, many years, you know, people thought that all the sort of weird things that go on at the subatomic level where particles can be connected across distances and they can be a wave and a particle at the same time, that these things can't possibly operate in biological systems in any meaningful way because these weird operations of physics seem to require cold, very stable environments to persist, and we're warm and wet as biological systems. But now they're finding that, you know, migrating birds, plants in photosynthesis, humans and the sense of smell, in fact, seem to be using quantum processes in a very effective and significant way. And that does open the door. Some people don't like hearing this, right? The atheists among us and the materialists among us don't like hearing this, but this does open up the door to the possibility that quantum effects will be found in our consciousness and in ways that might ultimately justify some paranormal claims. My problem with people on the paranormal side of the ledger is that they assume this to be so, and they insist that this must be so, that telepathy is a quantum process. Now, you know, we're still trying to sort out whether or not telepathy exists, let alone whether or not it's a quantum process.
As you explore this, you and we've already talked about this a little bit, you are so frustrated by the media. I mean, not only do you wish that the world of science would explore some of this more seriously, but you also wish that the media were, in a sense, more respectful and would tackle these topics differently than it does. And again, we're not talking about some of those TV specials and certain TV series that go, as far as I'm concerned, to the opposite extreme.
Exactly.
And all, of course, for the sake of ratings. But what would you have the media do in a very sort of nuts and bolts kind of way? What's some tangible advice you would have for the media in exploring some of these topics?
In a phrase or a sentence, pick the low-hanging fruit. This is, in the journalistic vernacular, paranormal stories are low-hanging fruit. They are juicy, juicy stories that involve human beings confronting unexplained phenomena and seeing their lives shift in various ways because of this, and seeing their worldviews challenged because of this. And that is the stuff of which great narratives are made. And that's one of the things I tried to focus on in the book, is to tell some stories so that people can see that these are really compelling articles, if you will. I mean, it's a book, and there are chapters in a book, but, you know, somebody could take this on as a magazine piece or a newspaper article just as easily. Here in Philadelphia, in Bucks County, they've had a UFO flap that's gone on off and on for a year or so now, maybe a little more, and no one's covered it. So I would like to see the media take these stories on and cover them in a way that gets at the real poignancy of what these experiences are like for the people who go through them, for the loved ones who watch them go through them, and the questions they raise for the rest of us about, well, what did they see in the sky? Exactly.
I'm reminded of a conversation that took place on this program many years ago, actually by my predecessor, who created and once hosted the show, speaking with somebody from the show Nova. The topic happened to be that of alien abductions. And one of the points that was made is that many people who believe that alien abductions occur, among in their sort of system of belief, is also this, you know, sort of this conspiracy idea that for some reason the world of the media does not want any of this to be uncovered, that the media is going out of its way to not uncover any of this or to release to the world evidence which they might have gathered that would support this. And in that conversation, the point was made that that is preposterous.
Yeah.
That any reporter who could confirm the existence of aliens coming to Earth and abducting people, I mean, that would be the story of the century, maybe the biggest news story in history.
Yeah.
And
there's a Pulitzer coming your way.
Absolutely,
if you tell that story.
You'd be set for life. So in a sense, it's I bring that up because it's probably important for us to make that distinction. That's not what you're saying when you deride the media or call them to task.
I'm not even deriding the media. I just think the stigma associated with all these topics is so great that any reporter who covers them feels like they have to do so with their tongue in their cheek, so that the reader gets that they're not vested in this personally. And I think that is part of what needs to go away here, that just cover it straight. You don't feel like you need to put your tongue in your cheek when you're covering any particular politician, whether you agree with them or not. Just tell the story. And even if you do have a point of view, come out with it very directly, not in this sort of weird, oblique way that just sort of distorts the way you cover it, you know? I think that if you look at the way there was a telepathy study done by a guy at Cornell last year, Daryl Bem, and it's really funny because if you look at the way mainstream media covered it, it was a very successful study, and it was published in a pretty esteemed psychological journal, the name of which is escaping me at the moment. And the New York Times did an article in which they just had a murderer's row of skeptics completely dismiss the research, and they did so mostly without, almost uniformly, without even referencing any problem that might actually be there in the study, aside from the fact that it came up with a conclusion that cannot be possible because telepathy simply can't exist. I'm just saying, why not spend a little more time digging into it and tell a story that's a bit more true, and in that sense, it becomes a bit more balanced. But I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, this idea that somehow the information's all just lying out there for reporters to get, and they're part of some agenda that keeps them from reporting on it. That's the sort of conspiracy. I hate to use the word craziness, but it verges on that.
Right.
You know, the sort of conspiracy thinking that's not helpful.
Right. Certainly not helpful to your purpose in a book like this. You write at one point, I think, I love your choice of words here. This is towards the end of the introduction. I'm arguing that we learn to talk about so-called paranormal issues productively. so that believers and disbelievers alike gain a better understanding not only of how the world works, but of themselves and each other. But really, I think that's especially noteworthy, this notion of being able to talk about paranormal questions and issues productively. I mean, we just don't have enough productive conversations about anything these days, but certainly that's true around this.
I think that we come into these conversations now as if they are debates, and somebody must emerge a winner and someone else must emerge a loser. I think we need to enter into these engagements in the spirit of conversation, where there's going to be some give and take. There's some understanding that at the end of this, we may not agree and that's okay. And I think that just creates a different dynamic in the conversation where now, look, I mean, if somebody comes at you with hostility, your inclination is to dismiss everything that they say. I mean, that would just be a neurological function. You start to shut down, you know, any rational thinking, and you just sort of want to get away from this person that's attacking you or attack them back and shut them down. And debate, that's what it fosters and encourages, is, you know, conversation as combat. And so I think in these realms, we need to at times set that idea aside, that someone's going to walk away a winner and someone's going to walk away a loser. The problem is, I think, the people who are really vested in this, that's not what they want. They want to win. And that goes for both skeptics and believers. I just did a story for Philadelphia Magazine here on an astronomer at the Franklin Institute, a very esteemed guy, who just went ahead and endorsed what I consider a pro-UFO book, and said that we need to start being willing to look at these things scientifically, because where something's unidentified, we should be able to discuss this rationally and without any sense of stigma. And his name's Derek Pitts. And it's a very respectful article in the tone of it. And I'm being savaged on the message board by people who are interpreting me as not being pro-UFO enough and having somehow, you know, mocked this guy when it's just not there in the language. It's just not there on the page. But they're so prone to seeing anything that isn't celebrating their position as an attack, that they're seeing neutral words as inflammatory words. And we need to be just mindful of that and respectful of that. I'm getting ready. When we hang up, I'm going to post something very conciliatory and say, hey, let's talk about this, because I didn't write what I think you're reading. So, you know, give me a line that troubles you and let's unpack it. And I think I'll be able to turn this around. Because, I mean, that's the experience I've had. But you need to be willing to come at somebody with some compassion and understanding and respect. And too often in these sorts of debates, well, you know, we approach it as debates. And we just try and smack the other guy down. That's a mistake.
Do you have time for a couple more questions?
You bet I do. This has been really enjoyable.
Let's reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Steve Volk. This book is called Fringeology: How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. Explain to our listeners the array of paranormal topics and questions that you actually tackle through the body of the book itself.
Well, I'll tell you, I get into life after death and near-death experiences, telepathy, the riddle of consciousness, ghosts, spoon bending, And I take a turn. I guess I said UFOs, right? UFOs. And I take a turn at some point away from issues that are sort of normally considered paranormal toward issues that are more directly associated with spirituality and spiritual concerns. So I start looking into meditation, prayer, and lucid dreaming as the book moves on, because I think for a lot of people, these debates actually become one and the same, you know, that somehow ghosts and telepathy are about mysticism and whether or not God exists. And I don't agree with that point of view, but I think a lot of people look at it that way. So I thought, well, I'll go ahead and get into some of these other topics as well.
The chapter that talks initially about life after death, that topic actually comes up at a couple different points in the book. But in the first chapter of the book, you share information about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that I didn't know. I, like most Americans, am well aware of her book on death and dying and of the five stages that most of us follow in our grief process. But you tell us about, and I had just the vaguest recollection of this, of how Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at some point became quite intrigued with also this notion of near-death experiences, and that her classic book originally was going to include an entire chapter on this phenomenon. Tell us more about
fantastic.
That.
Isn't it just fantastic? I mean, when the Reverend Walamu Amara, her research partner, told me this, it was a jaw-hitting-the-floor moment for me. Because Kubler-Ross became associated with near-death experiences in the years, like about 6 years after On Death and Dying came out. But very few people are aware, and it's very little information has sort of escaped about how involved she was with these in the period she was researching On Death and Dying. So during that whole time in the mid to late 60s, as she was doing that research and listening to the terminally ill talk about the psychological trauma associated with confronting their own deaths, she was also hearing other stories from them. She was hearing stories of, you know, if they were resuscitated, they would say, I left my body. I could see the resuscitation taking place. They would seem to describe this accurately. They would talk about seeing deceased relatives, maybe visiting another realm, not particularly wanting to come back, but being given a choice whether to do so or not. All the things that you hear about now in connection with these classic near-death experiences. And at first, she just sort of rejected these, and so did Amara. They just kept trucking on. But they kept hearing these sorts of stories so frequently, and they noticed that the patients who underwent these experiences were more accepting of their fate. They were better handling their terminal prognosis by far than the people who hadn't had these kinds of experiences. And so it seemed to them they'd better start taking notes on this as well. And from a data collection perspective, it makes perfect sense. You know, you're interviewing and surveying a population. They're frequently telling you stories like these. You need to start taking them down. They're also telling stories of something called deathbed visitations, in which they would be conscious and in bed and then say that a deceased relative was in the room. And they could see them and no one else could, and that they were there to prepare them, essentially, to cross over, that sort of thing. So they collected enough of these once they decided to start tabulating them that when she sat down and write On Death and Dying, she wrote a whole chapter concerning this stuff. And the book was due literally the next day. She was supposed to pack it into the mail and send it off. This is when we did this by mail. And she had Reverend Amara come over to look at the manuscript one last time and to talk about it. And the most important thing they discussed was this chapter. She said, you know, do I include this? And he talked her out of it. He talked her out of including it. Because the stigma associated already with what she was going to be addressing was so great, and she was going to be presenting such a challenge to fellow scientists and to Western medicine, that for her to also put forth data that suggested even the possibility of an afterlife would have just been way, way too much, too far out of bounds. And she agreed with him that the stakes were so high for the patients they were writing about in terms of just getting the care they needed at the time of their terminal illness that she couldn't risk torpedoing the whole book with this other chapter. So she removed it, and it never went to the publisher. It remained out of sight.
Mm. You write these words: Kubler-Ross was already taking on an incredibly taboo topic, death. The idea that she might end a book that already challenged the biases of the powerful medical profession with an oh-by-the-way chapter suggesting the possibility of an afterlife would have been way, way too much. Her entire life's work would have been dismissed. I find this so intriguing because I think whatever one thinks about life after death, or if these near-death experiences that are recounted in fact are what they feel like to those who experience them, no matter what you think about that, I think just hearing the story of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and of these kind of choices she felt compelled to make, that in and of itself is just really, really fascinating. To think about somebody caught in this kind of situation with the professional stakes being so high and forced to make this kind of choice.
It speaks to how twisted up our relationship with the paranormal is, because in hindsight, it's very, very clear that she was getting real data. Hospice workers to this day report this deathbed visitation phenomenon. I met some recently who told me about this. And the near-death experience is an accepted fact of science now that this goes on. The question is, what's the source of it? But it's a real phenomenon. And so she felt she had to hide this real phenomenon because it had this paranormal taint associated with it. That tells you loud and clear, I think, that we need to reframe the way we look at these things, period. Like, I don't even see room for debate there. We need to reframe it because here's data, and we should be able to talk about it. And the idea that we can't even present the data, that has nothing to do with science. That has nothing to do with the, you know, really the foundation of Western civilization, which is that we talk about things, we make progress, we're supposed to put forth ideas and then, you know, consider them. I mean, it's just a act of democracy, let alone science. But the certain things come up, and we have to keep them in the dark. And that just seems wrong to me.
Right. One thing that is, of course, a point of great contention is kind of this, I suppose it goes back to the matter of wanting things to become debates with winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that perfectly valid point, there is kind of the matter of burden of proof. And this seems to be something in which a number of people who embrace the reality for them of paranormal activity don't maybe seem to grasp. The idea that it is not for the rest of the world the rest of the world does not have the burden of proof of disproving those matters. The burden of proof should rest on someone making an extraordinary claim.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is not enough for them to say, you can't talk me out of this. But I mean, they bear the burden of proof, ultimately, if you're going to make an extraordinary claim about telepathy or anything else.
Sure. Sure.
That seems to be kind of a cold, hard reality with which a lot of folks in this camp just don't want to contend.
Yeah, well, a couple of things there, though. I think on a societal level, you're right. I mean, if you want people to agree that we have this collective base of knowledge that includes telepathy, you need to present evidence for that. However, I think there is a difference between private knowledge and public knowledge, right, or what you're prepared to accept privately and personally and what you expect other people to buy into. And so from the people out there who feel they've had some compelling personal experiences that cause them to believe, but they're not trying to sort of force that on anybody else as, you know, this is why you should believe, you know, I'm all right with that. I really am. And I also think there's a point at which the burden of proof begins to shift. So if somebody wants to say that the near-death experience is proof of an afterlife, they need to present evidence of that. And so far in a sort of a cold, hard scientific way, we don't yet have a sort of a hit, as it were, where somebody left their body and saw some randomly controlled target that the scientist knew was there and that the person who's claiming to have seen it would have no way of knowing was there. We don't have that yet. We do have some compelling, you know, what they call veridical perceptions, where people leave their body and they seem to be able to recall things they shouldn't have been able to recall. But that's not enough, you know, from a scientific perspective. What I think happens, though, is the burden of proof then shifts. If somebody says, well, you know what, I actually think that the NDE can be explained in purely neurological terms, they're now making a claim, and they need to present evidence to support that claim. Otherwise, we're left with a phenomenon that remains unexplained. And I think the skeptics need to be willing to admit that. So, you know, it goes both ways to some extent. And it leaves us back in that position where we need to be willing to say at times, I do not know. We do not have a final answer. And I think, for instance, to address the NDE head on, we don't yet have a working model for how various circumstances and drugs, you know, people might be taking or whatever. And by drugs, I mean anything from illicit narcotics to, you know, anesthesia or things that you might be given in the hospital, produce an NDE of a particular character with particular content. And until we have that, we don't really have a full explanation for the near-death experience. And I think skeptics need to be willing to admit that as well. This remains a mystery. And, you know, I'm open to any outcome.
I wanted to mention also that in a past interview, I won't mention the book by title. We're talking about your book today. But I will say that it was a book about alien abductions, and a very serious book about that topic. And ultimately what our the author said about alien abductions, and I don't know too many people who are willing to acknowledge that aliens are coming down from space and abducting people and doing experiments on them. I mean, this would be one of the farther out, far out possibilities, I should think. But her thought was that, and her study seemed to indicate that in the lives of many of these people making these claims, that this was for them ultimately a source of comfort, even if on the surface it was something. I mean, who in their right mind would want to be to have had this happen to them? Who would talk themselves into believing that they'd underwent, you know, terribly unpleasant and frightening experiments, you know, at the hand of an alien, sometimes more than once? But she found in her study, or came to believe, that for many of these people, this was a means by which they could explain maybe the unhappiness of their life, of why they have such trouble with their relationships, why they can't hold a job, why they suffer certain mental or emotional unbalance. For them, this was an explanation. And the comfort it brought in having some kind of explanation in and of itself was enough for them to form this opinion of something which to most of us seems utterly preposterous, something that cannot possibly be true. I found that to be such an intriguing possibility. And I wonder, as you have dealt with so many people who seem to have experienced the paranormal in one way or another, if that seems at all to be a possibility.
I think certainly it is. But I think we also need to remember that skeptics are often heartened by the possibility that people are just fanciful, because they like to live in a world that's predictable and rational and completely scientific. And so for them, the fact that some people are fantasizing becomes all people are fantasizing. That some people are reaching toward these things for comfort becomes, there you go. People reach toward these things for comfort. And so I just wanted to twist that around quickly, because I think we need to understand we're all human beings with brains that function in the same way, and we seek to preserve our worldviews. But yes, I did run across people who used the paranormal this way. And in particular, I did run across some alien abductees who did this. There was a person in particular who sort of floored me, because they claimed to have an alien implant inside of them. And when I said, do you want to have it removed and looked at? And their answer was no, that they felt that, it was there for some higher purpose and blah, 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 blah. But I left thinking that they so enjoyed the status that saying they had an alien implant conferred upon them in this tight, small community of people who, are really vested in this, that the last thing they want to do is have it looked at and risk seeing that it was just a shard of glass that, had been embedded in them as a kid and had just, enough scar tissue had formed around it now that there was a bump there. That sort of thing happens. Something real quick I want to say about the abductee phenomenon, though, that interests me, and that interests me in relation to all these sorts of paranormal things, is that a lot of these abductees, if you really look at the literature, they are very, very, very deeply troubled by this and remain troubled by it. And moreover, a lot of them are troubled by it initially and then come to rationalize it in some way. I think the author you're talking about is Susan Clancy. That they come to rationalize it in some way that they eventually look at it as a source of comfort. If you look at the Whitley Strieber movie Communion, in which Christopher Walken played Strieber, that's exactly the odyssey his character undertakes. And I haven't done full research on this subject, but I've read up some on it, and it seems to be the odyssey the average abductee takes. They're very, very troubled by it. They don't want this to be happening. They don't want to think this is happening, and they come to think of it in a way that gives them peace. That's a very different psychological phenomenon than the one that the skeptics usually put forward. And I think that whatever's happening there, again, it's simply more complicated, at least, right, than the explanations we have now. I am not saying that people are being abducted by aliens. I can't wrap my mind around that one.
Right.
But I do think that when we just sort of take an explanation that sounds close enough for horseshoes, we're missing something, and we're stripping the people who are reporting these things of, I think, of a little or a lot of their dignity at times.
Hmm. That's part of what makes all of this so complicated. And again, I appreciate that you have taken such care and sensitivity with this topic in your book, Fringeology, published by HarperCollins, the author Steve Volk. Steve Volk, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book. It gave me a lot to think about.
Thank you so much for having me. And this is honestly, I've done over 30 interviews now. This is one of the